Hello, girls, boys, and everyone in between. I'm Scarlett.
I'm Roxy.
And I'm Marjorie.
And we are the Red Resistance Podcast.
Before we get started, a little light housekeeping. Please rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. It helps us get a little higher up on the podcast food chain, but also, we just really like to know how we're doing. Head pats make us very giddy. Also, please check out our Patreon. Patreon is essentially an online tip jar. You have the option of making a one-time donation or becoming a monthly sustaining donor of varying tiers. There, you will have access to cut content, ridiculous outtakes from those days where our deviations are too precious to delete, and early episode releases. We know times are tough. They are for us, too. But if you're lucky enough to have a little to spare, throw some at us on Patreon. It helps keep the lights on and the Hulu subscription running. Find us on patreon.com/theredresistance or search on Patreon for the Red Resistance Podcast. We appreciate it so very much. Finally, be aware that there will be spoilers from the book, future episodes of the show, and potential tie-ins to the book's sequel, The Testaments. They are not detailed and serve to further the analysis of the show. It will be okay, I promise. So with that, grab the beverage of your choice and let us commence dissecting our favorite dystopian TV show. Well, hey there, podcast buddies. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Scarlett. How are you?
I'm just ducky. Yeah. What's happening, Roxy?
Oh, not too much. Just literally burning the midnight oil right now with you two. I'm really in a good mood and very interested in hearing your thoughts on this episode.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts in this episode. I don't feel great about my thoughts, so you're going to have to bear with me for this. I'm going to try really hard to rein it in, but I'm resurrecting light theory for this episode, like real hard. So I know a lot of people probably don't even know what I'm talking about. And honestly, you're probably better off in the long run. I'm going to try to keep this relatively concise as to what exactly I'm looking at in this episode and how it relates to what I said before. And then I was kind of getting this like weird, not weird. I was feeling like I was rabbit holing in the way I did in Lights in season 3 with boxes in season 4. And so I was trying to like reel it in a little bit because, you know, you can see a box in every scene if you look for one. So it's, yeah. It's, you know, I was trying to just focus more on the like real obvious ones. And naturally, light theory just comes out and slaps you in the face in this first scene. And then I looked at it and I was like, wow, it's also shape theory. So light and shape theory have combined and I just can't avoid it. So I'm going to try not to talk about every circle and shape and box in this episode, but I will give you a little brief rundown. And I am drinking a drink called Down the Rabbit Hole because that's exactly what I've done for this episode. So I'm just feeling like I don't want to be crazy light lady, but it's going to happen. So here we are.
We have a lot of new listeners for this season, and the reason why Marjorie is curbing herself with the whole light theory thing is because once upon a time when we were tiny baby podcasters back in season 3, because that's when we started this shit, we did this light theory rabbit hole. Actually, Marjorie started it and we were more than happy to jump on that train with her. And then we were like, the lights mean this and the lights and the lights and the lights until eventually we talked to Bruce Miller and he was like, no, calm down. It's not like that. But I like your ideas, but it's not like that. And we're like, okay, all right, right on. So we've been trying to reel it back in, you know?
Yeah. He said like anything that was in there wasn't intentionally. It's like every department puts their own spin and like helps to build the story, but like maybe not quite as intense as y'all are thinking.
And that was the issue I had, and I relived it this week because Scarlett alerted me to the first scene before I had watched it. So I kind of knew there was something coming that I needed to be refreshed on. So she had told me what episode we had talked about a very specific part of the lights. And so it is Witness Part 1. So I went back and listened to it, and you're right. It was definitely in there. And the problem I had with re-listening to this episode to get to this point is I probably could, I knew what scene I was looking for. I could have just skipped around, but I wanted to hear us and hear what we were saying about it. And unfortunately, all I talked about was lights the entire time, every scene. So scene by scene by scene, I was just like, are you ready to tell, can I tell you about lights now? Mm-hmm. And so lights and shapes are an issue for me because there's obviously lights in every scene and there's obviously shapes in every scene. So I'm just trying to not only see that. Fortunately for me, this episode is really, really dialogue rich, and I love, love, love some of these conversations. So I tried not to focus on too many lights and shapes, but we'll go there a little bit in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the middle, probably the end too.
Yeah.
So I just want to pop in with one little housekeeping thing. Somebody had messaged us the other day to be like, hey, where'd your political discussions during the recap go? We used to love that. Yeah, that is totally a thing that we used to do in season three. The issue is that this time around, we got these episodes early, as many of you know. So we're recording them earlier. And so we were concerned that by the time we have our political discussion about whatever bullshit is happening in the current events right now, that if we were to record it, then it ends up in the recording, which probably isn't necessarily going out for a week to 10 days. So the relevancy was a factor. So we definitely curbed the political talk back a little bit, mostly because of that, because, I mean, we don't want to put out a thing that has content that people were bitching about like 2 weeks ago. So we do plan on doing episodes in the future, which are more political and activism related stuff. We have people who have psychology backgrounds that are going to hopefully come on and chat with us. We've got somebody that's going to come talk to us about human trafficking, which is going to be really fucking cool. I've been dying to do this episode for like ever. And so we have plans and we will get back into that, you know, political talk, conversational saddle like we used to. It just doesn't make sense for us to do it right now. But we hear you. Mm-hmm. So, shall we drink?
Always.
Roxy, what do you got going on today?
I am having whiskey today because there's never a bad time to have whiskey. It is the perfect, it's the perfect dram when you're celebrating, when you're mourning, what have you. I'm not going to lie. I had a fucking time trying to figure out what to drink with this episode, like, because it is so dialogue heavy, it is so rich and intense, and they didn't throw us any softballs like they do occasionally, where it's just like, hey, we're gonna drink mimosas. So I opened up my cabinet about 5 minutes ago and found in it a bottle of an American single malt whiskey called Courage and Conviction.
Ooh,
goddamn.
The universe unfolds as it rightfully should sometimes.
Love that.
And this is a whiskey that is, it's from the Virginia Distilling Company. They use malted barley, fresh spring water, fed from the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's a combination of old world sherry casks, traditional bourbon barrels, and recouperage cuvee wine casks aged for a minimum of 3 years, which adds intensity and complexity to the spirit. But it's just kind of perfect because throughout this episode, we really see June having the courage to stand up to her abusers and face them in court and face the repercussions that can come of that. We see Emily it's thrust upon her, but she eventually has the courage to go and address one of her abusers and someone who's responsible for worlds of misery for her, even though it doesn't quite pan out the way that she may have hoped. We see Moira having the conviction to try to help all of these other women that have been through this intense struggle in Gilead. And we see quite a few different examples of courage being utilized. Like, I think Luke is incredibly brave in this episode to like continually try to like work towards having a discussion with June, and to show up at that courtroom as well was an incredible act of courage. And so that's why I'm drinking Courage and Conviction, because it's the first thing I found that actually worked as a tie-in.
Very nice.
I love it. That is impressive.
I agree.
I got lucky.
You also have a quite extensive cabinet there.
You do.
That is a good point.
Your cabinet is like my liquor store.
My cabinet is three wire racks in my garage, and then like a cabinet underneath as well. and a 200 bottle wine fridge.
See, now, in the events of a Gilead takeover, you are going to be everybody's favorite person in the neighborhood because you can use that booze to barter for other goods.
Oh, you think that booze is going to stay in the neighborhood? Oh, no, no, honey. All that booze is getting loaded up into the back of the car, and I'm going to use it for bartering for gas and to get across the border.
Either way, whatever. You can use it to barter. You're going to be all set.
It'll be fine.
Yeah.
What are you two drinking?
All right. Go for it, Scarlett.
Today, I'm knocking back some beer because it's what I do. I drink beer. I'm from New England. I talk like this. No, I don't at all, ever. Anywho, I was also really strapped for a tie-in today. I was like, I just don't know. There's so many places I could go. There's so many ways this episode made me feel. And I went to my local package store, the beer mecca of New England, and I was walking around like a fucking lost puppy. Like, I just don't know what to do. Sales girl comes along. She's like, can I help you? Because, you know, you seem like you're having a hard time making a decision after I was in the store for like a half hour. I explained to her what I needed, and she was like, okay, well, good luck. And she walked away. And I don't fucking blame her one bit. So I went with an old standby, but an old standby that still works, although just maybe not as cleverly as I would have wanted it to. I went with a collaboration between Microphone Brewery and Collective Arts again, The Origin of Darkness. So the one that is a four beer series. The one that I have today is it's maple syrup, bourbon barrel aged imperial stout with walnuts. Oh. This is a keeper. Artwork is fantastic. It's kind of, you know, it's along the lines of the artwork that they have from the other cans. I believe it's the same artist. It's Cassidy Ray Marietta out of Columbus, Ohio. Cassidy Ray, you do some cool fucking work, girl. But more importantly, it is brewed and barrel aged by Collective Arts in Hamilton, Ontario, where our favorite show is filmed. It's got a decently high ABV at 9.0%, which I'm sure will have me feeling pretty fucking fine by the end of this half. And Origin of Darkness, I mean, that's exactly how I perceived Fred and Serena coming back together. They came back to their roots. I could really see in their interaction with each other towards the end, I could see that back and forth that drew them together. So I feel like we are back to the beginning with these two. And I can't think of anything that is darker than them, not even Roxy's soul. So I give you Origin of Darkness.
Oh, yum. That's great. Cheers. You did really well. Your trip to the package store is me every single week. Every single week.
You're just lost me in there like, wandering. Like,
eventually I'll just see something and it'll work. I mean, hopefully I have like some kind of direction, but not always. And sometimes I get derailed. I can't find what I'm looking for. I think it'll work. All sorts of things happen. But I will tell you that every week I like wait and I almost kind of like brace myself and like stop myself from being like, well, let me tell you what I'm looking for. Because I'll talk to these people for like a half hour and they're going to be like, oh, yeah, good luck with you. I can't help you pick something for your podcast. So like, good luck. But I have yet to bring up a podcast yet. I normally just look confused. I bring my 13-year-old in to help me pick a beer. Yeah, it's never great. But this one actually was quite easy. And I got quite lucky because I was just hoping that they would have the whiskey I was looking for. I am drinking Rabbit Hole Rye. And solely because I already did kind of had the idea of like Rabbit Hole cocktail. I'm like, I pretty much can do anything with that. Like, I'll just name it that. And I can just drink what I want. And what I always want to drink is whiskey. So I figured at least a cocktail. I didn't want to go straight scotch or anything on the rocks, which is kind of what I was leaning towards. So I have a pretty perfect tie-in. And it's basically just my dumb luck of what I wanted to drink tonight. So I have my whiskey and I like a whiskey sour, but I've been finding that with this, with these recordings, I need something a little bit more watered down to last me more because I like to drink a lot. So it is club soda and lemon juice, lots and lots of lemon juice because I just love lemon juice and beet juice. Now, I like beet juice. I love beets. And I was waiting for an opportunity to use beets in a cocktail, and tonight was the night. But I didn't really have a tie-in for beets until I went to the internet, and I found, it's a little obscure, but stay with me for a minute, spiritoftransformation.com. It is the symbolism of beetroot. And I will spare you like all of the reading, but I'll just give you why it ties in perfectly. Beetroot is good for releasing war trauma and fear of lack of being able to trust and receive once more. Then it goes into a lot of conversation about how that wartime trauma can be personal, it can be generational, how it gets passed down. It's all really interesting. You should check it out. But it gives you an affirmation at the end. And the affirmation is, I ask the light to hold me steadfast and give me the strength to release the trauma that I have been afraid to remember. I move forward confidently at a safe, comfortable pace. And come on. That's a pretty damn good tie-in, right?
Yeah, it works. I'm down with it.
Yep. So I think June needs some wartime trauma healing, and I hope she finds it soon. But until then, rabbit hole whiskey.
Brilliant. Which rabbit hole did you go with?
I went with the rye.
Oh, very nice. For those of you that aren't aware, Rabbit Hole is a Kentucky distillery. They specialize in a few different iterations of bourbon. They also have a fantastic rye. So I'm glad you found it. Ladies, cheers.
Oh, and I can tell you the best part of it. My drink should be served in a circle glass with a square cube. I can't do that for this recording because I'll be clinking away. So if you really want to get right down to the perfect episode drink, you really have to have the big cube inside a circle glass.
Shall we?
Yes, let's. Oh, well, we got this opening scene. June is cutting her hair again, and it is symbolic every time that she does this. And, okay, so this song, Roxy, you said was a Portishead song, right?
Yep, it's Glory Box from Portishead.
And we've heard this song before, have we not? Which episode was it?
We've heard this song before in season one. I believe it was episode 5 or 6, but it was when we were in Jezebel's. At one point, it was in like the back alleyway of Jezebel's, like that like slow, heady, like like sexy music. Like I remember like hearing it and being like, this is very disarming because like where we're going is not the sort of place that we should be listening to this sort of music because it's like it's a very like sensual song. And like I feel like this was a much more appropriate setting for it. So Portishead is a band that was formed in like the early 90s in the UK. And the lyrics for this are so appropriate for this. I'm so tired of playing with this broken arrow. Da-da-da-da-da. Leave it to the other girls to play, for I've been a temptress too long. Give me a reason to be a woman. I just want to be a woman from this time unchained. We're all looking at a different picture through this new frame of mind. It just, like, is really leaning into her reclaiming her self and reclaiming her like her own sensuality and her own self-expression, which is mirrored when we see her after she's cut her hair just rubbing her neck and feeling that the hair isn't on her neck anymore and feeling that sense of liberation, because in the before times that's how June's always worn her hair.
Yeah. And then also like that hair thing, the thing with her hand on the back of her neck, that's a thing that she does when she's stressed too,
right.
So mm-hmm. It looks like this really sensual kind of like, I'm just not doing anything. I'm going to fuck around and cut my hair, get in my bathrobe kind of like thing. But there's more to it than that. And it also runs directly opposite of what Gilead wants and expects from women. Because Gilead, you know, they're not supposed to cut their hair. Where do you ever see a female with like short hair in Gilead? No. And that is absolutely a hardcore Christian fundamentalist belief that women should have long hair. It's their crowning glory. It should not be cut.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And there she is cutting it because it's her goddamn hair.
Exactly. And before I forget, at the very end of the episode, I'm going to do a little tie-in with the song that plays at the end. But something that's important of note is that Portishead's song Glory Box samples heavily Isaac Hayes's Ike's Rap 2/ Help Me Love.
Oh.
So you're just going to have to listen to the next 3 hours of us rambling on about this episode to get to that Easter egg.
That's just fine with me.
I'll be there.
Right on.
Cool. Sorry to interrupt. I just totally forgot about that.
It's okay. We deep dive. It's what we do.
We do. We rabbit hole.
Yes.
Yes, we do. I agree with you, Scarlett, that she was, there was more to it there, because I was thinking the same thing at first, especially with that music. And as she's cutting her hair, it just takes you right back to the Boston Globe. And it was so freeing and such, you know, she's taking this control back. It should feel good. And then by the end of the scene, I'm like, whoa, that did not feel good. Like, there, what just happened there? Why did that not feel good by the end? And when I went back, I was like, at first, it seems really sensuous when she's rubbing her skin. And all I could think of was, now that she's back in Canada with Luke, this had always been her dream and her fantasy, and where her mind would go when she needed an escape was to Luke. And the way she was touching her arm made me think of the episode where she is, I think it's the episode where June has to talk to Luke. You know, first the phone call, then the secret tapes. But I think in one of those flashbacks, she's thinking back to at least some time that they had a night out and they were dancing, and then they're going back and they're having sex. And it was all very sensual. And she's talking about touch there in that scene. And it reminded me of that. And I was like, wow, she doesn't have Luke now that she's back. And she's realizing that her and Luke have a lot more work to do to ever get back to that place, or if that place is even possible. But she's trying to, you know, discover herself. Like, I had all these thoughts. And then she went to the back of her neck. And all I could think of, Scarlett, was you, and how you're like, that is something she does when she's got a lot of anxiety. And I'm like, oh. And then that shot of her just looking straight up at the camera, and it was like she wanted it to be transformative, but in the end she's still saddled with all of the trauma. Like, you know, cutting her hair isn't going to really fix anything at the end of the day. And I think that's what I took away from the scene by the end of it, but it was a little jarring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely a great point. It's the notion of making this physical change, which should be a sort of sense of catharsis, but ultimately doesn't really create any sort of systemic change for her. Everything is still the same. I love that point.
Haircut ain't gonna do it. She's just not right yet.
No, which is why your hairstylist will always tell you not to cut your hair after a breakup. Doesn't change anything.
I've definitely done that.
I mean, we all have. It's just, you shouldn't.
Yeah. Well, while we're finishing out that scene, the voiceover begins for the next scene. And it says, I felt helpless. I guess it was a way to feel in control. And apparently this is a support group for survivors of Gilead. June, Emily, Moira are there. The lamps! Oh my God, the lamps! Let's talk about the lamps!
They're everywhere!
I lost my friggin' mind when I saw these lamps. Okay, let me explain why these lamps were a big fucking deal to us. It's because in season 3, when Marjorie was talking about the light theory thing, one of the key light theory things I remember her talking about was how when June was in the basement reading the Red Center dossiers of all of her handmade friends, and how she's surrounded by like a dozen freaking lights, and it's lights with white lampshades. And I remember you had said that they reminded you of bonnets. They reminded you of like white handmaid's bonnets. So it was like they were looking over her as she was reading the files about them. So she wasn't alone while she was going through this. Then we find out that maybe that wasn't necessarily a thing. And now all of a sudden, we get this episode that I watched ahead because I'm an impatient little shit and I could not wait. So I watched it, and then here I am watching it like 2 weeks before the other two can watch it. And I'm just sitting there like, I can't even say anything about this. God damn it. This is why I shouldn't have watched ahead. But these lamps, they looked like freaking handmade bonnets, and that had to be on purpose. And guys, was that on purpose?
It has to be. It's too perfect. And, you know, I'm going to probably take it to a much more, you know, subjective viewpoint with everything that I see here. But I feel like if nothing else, yes, the lights are meant to look like handmaids in the handmaid support circle. That's it. That I will double down on. That happened intentionally.
Absolutely.
And they're scattered. I mean, it's not even like just in the handmaid circle. They're like throughout the whole damn library, and they're all over the place. That was, yes, I agree there. But one of the things that was more prevalent through all of this light theory talk was that the artificial light is essentially Gilead and Gilead oversight of some sort versus natural light, which is more or less just like truth, right? And so, because there's just so much beautiful lighting and natural light. And I think I was just really trying to find more there than really just sometimes beautiful shots and ugly, terrible scenes and the juxtaposition of that. So, but here, they're also sitting in a circle, these refugees. And this is where I was like, oh, God, I can't keep doing circles and lights in the same scene, but we're going to go there because it's so perfect. So you have four little handmade lights. And if you think of it as Gilead, just even just symbolically Gilead, they're just always there. They can't get rid of it. It's exactly what we just talked about. June cutting her hair isn't going to change anything. Gilead's still inside her. It's become part of her. All of that trauma is now part of her, and it changes the way she acts every day. And this is a circle of refugees. So we were talking about how circles is more of a Canadian thing. She's trying to get out of the box. And then all of a sudden on her trip to Canada, there's like circles everywhere. And so they're sitting in a circle in the dark. And all you see are these red handmade lamps. And it's the same thing with the scene that we had seen in season three of they're red. It's not just that they're these lamps that look like the handmade angel wings, but they actually are giving off this red tint to them. So within the circle, there's four very specific lamps making a box. And I'm like, wow, even in Canada, you can't get out of the box. Like the circle in the box, like they obviously don't fit together. And these refugees, they don't fit anywhere else. Like they have all this trauma and they're trying to move forward with their life in Canada, but they can't because they've got this Gilead stuck within them. And here it is, right? Spelled out in lights and shapes for me. So that is the end of light theory for the most part. But that one is as concise as I can explain it. I did much better than I thought it would. So the end.
That was well done.
Until the next scene, because don't worry, there's still more, but that's the basic gist of it. But also, I just love the shot because, first of all, let's talk about the fact that they're in a library. So that's like, hello, not Gilead. I love that. And it's a beautiful library with all of this natural light, but it's night. So all you get is a skyline. And it almost looks like those handmade lights extend forever because they are throughout the library as well. And then you just see like the skyline lights. And it just looks like, you know, no matter where these women go in their day-to-day lives, Gilead will be somewhere lurking. And it's like what we were talking about with the PTSD. Like you never know what's going to trigger you and what's going to bring it out and give you some kind of response and interrupt you just trying to live. And I think that's more or less what this entire episode is about.
Absolutely. There is one other thing that I wanted to point out with the lights as well is once I saw those bonnets, I thought immediately went to perhaps these are meant to be like from a visual standpoint, memorials or totems to the handmaids that had passed.
Because there were four
that weren't able to make it. At first, I was like, oh, obviously Alma, Brianna. I was like, and Janine. I was like, but that's only three. Why are there four? And then I thought more on it, and I noticed that there was an empty chair as well. So you have Sarah, Ellie, Alma, and Brianna. And then we also had June, Moira, and Janine. Those are our seven handmaids that were mentioned at the end of season four, episode three, Crossings, in that sort of like when all seven of them were shown at the very end. Those are our seven core handmaids, like of the names that we should remember. And we know Sarah, Ellie, Alma, and Brianna didn't make it. We have confirmation of this, that those four are dead. And I've like looked at those like bonnet lights as like a sort of memorial to them. And the empty chair, I was like, that's Janine. That's our unanswered question.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So like for me, it was sort of them dangling like that, like, is she or isn't she card? Like I rabbit hole a little bit about the, lights as well, and like in like that slightly different way. But like when I noticed that there was four lights there and not five, like immediately I was like, not immediately, but like once I started to like go down that tangent, I was like, Janine's still alive, and they're gonna show it in this episode.
Oh, you're good.
Nah. Oh. it took a second of looking at that and looking at those damned lights before like things started to kind of click.
Awesome.
So I hope that that's where they were going with the lights, was they were trying to give us like some sort of like lighting theory hints, like that, like we're not off base. I hope those were Easter eggs for us specifically. Thank
that
you.
That would be super cool.
I took it as such. And no one's going to tell me otherwise because I won't even ask.
Anyway, I thought that the conversation that these handmaids were having was really compelling as well, where they were talking about their coping mechanisms and how one of them was talking specifically about cutting. And Moira asked the question, like, didn't your commander notice? And she responded with, I cut high up on my arms, that way they wouldn't see it. And Moira brings up a good point of cutting as a way to cope, as a coping mechanism. And the girl that was talking talked about how, like, it gave her, like, some sort of sense of release. And this is a normal thing that you hear with people that do any sort of self-mutilation or self-harm, is that it's something that they have control over. So I thought that I really appreciated that they discussed this, because invariably one has to imagine that this sort of behavior is rampant throughout these handmaids, but they're in this horrific scenario. They're fully alienated. There's no focus on mental health whatsoever, which we really leaned in season 3 when we were talking about Eleanor. And how else is one to cope? Also, one has to imagine that suicide rates are relatively high amongst handmaids, and cutting is one of the steps of a natural to the natural progression of a suicide. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're suicidal, but it is.
It's definitely a sign of mental distress and pain.
Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that they were willing to have this conversation on the show about different signs of how people cope with or don't cope with their state of mental duress.
But it's interesting to see another side of coping and of the same trauma, because these people have all more or less, obviously everyone's situation is always going to be entirely unique, but they all have a much more similar shared experience than most of the people that they're going to be interacting with on a day-to-day basis. And it's coming right off the scene where the first thing I wrote in my notes as June was cutting her hair was she's taking back control. And so we've seen all the ways in which June copes with all of the traumas that she's experienced. And it's interesting to cut right to the next scene where she's saying, yeah, I cut because it was a control, it was a release. And then she goes into all of it. And it's like, it was the first sign that we're seeing that throughout the rest of the episode, we're going to see that June is coping differently than they are. I mean, we see it right in the next scene when she has a conversation with Moira of, despite their similar experiences, they have different feelings, and get into all of that. I think it's kind of very obvious to me why their feelings would be different for a lot of reasons. But like when June and Moira are having that conversation in between the little books, and June says, you know, I don't understand why they're not angry.
It comes down to different coping mechanisms work for different people based off of any number of factors. People can go through the exact same trauma, but they're going to work through it in any manner of ways, depending on what tools they already had in their mental health toolbox before going through the trauma and what's going to work best for them. In a case of June, when all the other survivors of Gilead are discussing June facing Fred in the courtroom, and June says, I'm not nervous or worried or scared. I can't fucking wait. You can just tell, like, that this is a different attitude than some of these other survivors might have. So it kind of plays into, like, her saying, like, you know, like later on when she and Moira are talking in the stacks, like, I thought I'd have more in common with them. And, like, you know, failings, forgiveness, journaling, like, you can tell it's not how she copes. And my big frustration here, though, is, yeah, you should feel that anger and, like, you should work through that. But her not understanding how that might be some other people's way of coping is effectively not giving them the space that they need to cope in the manner that's best mm-hmm. for them.
Agreed. It also points to the fact that this type of coping stuff isn't adequate for June. I think that it's to the point where she's had a very unique experience. Like, I think that her experience has been an experience that some parts of it, the women in that group can understand because they most certainly lived it. But I don't think that they've had to deal with the shit that June has. I mean, like, yeah. there is this really, like, some next level fuckery with June's situation that I don't know if she feels like hearing these stories, if she feels like she really belongs here. If there was another woman in that group that was talking about some of the stuff that she has been through, maybe then that, like, and it was similar to June's, there's a possibility that June could be there with her and be like, oh my God, my person, you fucking get it. You know, oh, you went to the torture center too. Oh, you dealt specifically with Aunt Lydia too. Like, I don't know, mm-hmm. like something to make her feel like she belonged there. She doesn't feel like she belongs there right now. So it kind of, like, it goes both ways. And then the other thing too is that this whole a lot of this episode has been about people speaking up when they're feeling like they're ready to speak up or when they want to take the opportunity to speak up. And there's so many instances, like, for example, in this group right now where she's talking. Actually, she didn't even get a chance to talk. It was other people talking about her and her situation, and she hadn't even really spoken about it yet. So it's almost like they weren't letting her speak about her own thing. Yes. So this is not adequate for her. End of story. This whole experience is not adequate for her. I mean, actually, you know what? Let's just say that we're pretty sure that nobody else in that group has had the experience that she has. Because like Moira said, she doesn't come with her own security. They don't come with their own security detail.
Yeah, but she says it's even more than that. And I agree that it is. It's not just that. I agree with you that she has experiences that are entirely unique, especially her refugee experiences. But also, hey, how long has she really been there? We can assume at least less than everyone else has, right?
Yeah.
So she's a lot more fresh off the trauma. And on top of that, what's the coolest thing to me is I had said at some episode, probably the last one, that like she really needs more people around her that have gone through the same thing to kind of get support from. And then I see it in this first scene and I'm like, oh, good. But then I'm like, oh, my gosh, by the end of it, I'm like, she doesn't even need the support from the group. The group needed her to lead them. And that's what I think is really interesting, is because she does step right in there and say, OK, enough's enough. Like she steps into that leadership role of this group
real quick.
No problem. Like, yeah. This is June now. This is the June and what she's grown into.
She kicks Moira out of that position.
Yeah,
like, I wouldn't say she steps into an open leadership position. She usurps it.
Well, yeah, does. I mean, yeah. I don't think it was open, but she definitely doesn't care. Like, she's looked at Moira the same way she looked at Steven. She just got less pushback of, I don't really care what you say. I'm going to just call the shots. And Steven's like, no, you're not. And Moira's like, what the hell is happening right now? But it was also interesting that they're coping. It's not working for them either. And I think that's the point that we see by the end of it, is that, yes, Moira is saying a lot of things that I'm sure are entirely accurate. And
absolutely,
of course, you shouldn't have the anger and all of that. But also, it almost minimizes their experience by saying they shouldn't have anger. And June's like, fuck that shit. I'm angry. And I'm still angry. And this is all fresh to me. And I think the most unique thing of all of June's experience, and the reason why she can kind of lead them to a different way of coping, a way of releasing, a different way of healing. And it's because she gets to face her abuser, the face of her, of all of her trauma. In Canada, how many of them get that? They have to find journaling and support groups, because they come here and they're told, first of all, they're going to be surrounded by people who are not fresh off trauma. And the first thing they're going to say is exactly the stuff that Moira's saying of, you need to let it go. You need to learn to move on. You need to find what freedom looks like for you. Find what this new life looks like. But June's finding out that there is no new life. The life that she had hoped was in Canada isn't. Her best friend or husband and one of her children is still there. And none of it is looking like anything that she ever hoped it would be. It doesn't feel good. And she gets to go see Fred and Serena face to face and testify, to confront all of it. So I think that's the most unique part of her experience, is that she can confront and have anger and put it into an outlet that's helpful instead of cutting, which would be a harmful. You know what I mean? Like, I get that they're both outlets, but at least June's outlet seems to make her feel better in the end. And it seems to make Emily feel better, too. But we'll get there.
Yeah.
Right. Which is probably also why she was so insistent upon pushing Emily towards, who is this person? Why is this person? Which, again, like you said, we'll get to. I find it interesting your notion about how you brought up the trivializing of experiences, because I think that, like, inadvertently, June, and I am very much an angry person, I would cope with this the same way that June would, where it's just like, oh no, we confront it, we talk about this, we bring it on head on, and you feel that anger, and like, you acknowledge it. But there's also an understanding that not everyone works like that. Some people need to have that peaceful release instead. So I understand where June is coming from with wanting to confront her anger and feel it and wanting to help the other girls in the group do that. And ultimately, I do agree with her, but I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment. Do either of you feel like her demanding those sort of emotions from the other people, do you feel like that trivializes their own healing experience if it were to have worked for them?
I don't think it trivializes it, but I think that it's taking the healing experience away from the person whose healing experience it belongs to. I do believe at the bottom of it, June believes that all their experiences are equally terrible and horrific. I do believe that.
Yeah, I feel like it was, it definitely made me a little uncomfortable. But I also, I felt frustrated for June in the next scene where that I think propelled her a lot closer to demanding of Emily. I don't even know if it's the next scene, but the scene where it's Moira and Luke and Emily and June all sitting at the table, like that was very frustrating to me. And I suppose we'll talk about that when we get to that scene. But that was, I felt like they were trivializing June in that scene. And that is what made me start to realize that, you know, maybe all of these refugees are feeling the same way of being told to cope in ways that are not what they necessarily want. Because what jumped out at me is by the end when June pulls the group and was basically like, well, Moira's ending it, but I'll stick around. And everyone stays. Like, that's what really jumped out at me as, wow, maybe it was June that needed, because she's so fresh off the trauma, that she understands, and because she's so poised in leading groups of women that have from Gilead, we won't call them handmaids now that they're in Canada, but she's already stepped into this role of I'm going to lead you and help you. And I think that's, I don't know, that's just more of what I saw. But it did make me uncomfortable that she was very much forcing Emily to confront her face and then tried to be like, well, it's up to you. But here she is.
Two things before we continue with this episode, because this is pretty much where I stand throughout this whole back and forth with June trying to help people in the healing capacity, is that number one, June, when she was at, I don't know, I'll just call it the torture center because we don't have a name for it. The torture center.
Gilead Guantanamo?
Yeah. Gilead Gitmo. When June was at Gilead Gitmo and Aunt Lydia and her had that face-off, this before the Hannah thing and stuff, and June really got to lay into her about how Lydia failed and how she is a horrible person, and these girls, you know, are just fucked because of her. Like, Lydia, you failed in your mission to protect them. Good for you. That is some of the most hurtful shit that you could possibly say to somebody, but it's the most perfect thing that you could say to somebody who is your tormentor. Remember how she smiled after that, after Lydia wanted out of that room, and she just looked like exhilarated. June knows that feeling. She wants other people to have that feeling. And I betcha that is the best that June has felt in the last several episodes, honestly.
Yeah. Well, and after Serena, too.
Like, yeah, and the Serena thing. Like, those two things.
For all we know, this could have been yesterday for June. And she's like, hey, support group, I got plans.
Exactly. Like, those are her two biggest tormentors are Serena and Aunt Lydia. And she got to say exactly what she needed to them. And it made her feel absolutely fantastic. So I'm sure she's sitting there in this support group capacity. Like, we could just take the direct route. I mean, if you guys want, like, you know, later on we have this chick. Why not? Let's just let it out. You could be wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, done with your healing process right now. If you just lay into this woman and let her know how you ruined my life and make them feel so bad that they're probably going to go kill themselves. Emily did anyway with a very small sentence. But I think that's what June is envisioning, is that same sort of ferocity. And the other thing, too, is that, like, from my experience, lots of experience in, like, therapy and therapy settings with myself and my family, is that there is this concept of exposure therapy. My experience with that is in an OCD capacity, doing exposure therapy for OCD stuff. But I kind of look at what June does in this episode as a type of exposure therapy. And in exposure therapy, in my experience with it, there are times where you do need to push somebody outside of their comfort zone for the sake of taking that step that could potentially be healing. Because doing the same thing over and over again doesn't work. You might want to try something different. And so I feel like that's what she was doing here. So there's that side of the coin, too, is that maybe that push that she gave them that is completely different from what they've been dealing with in their group therapy is what some of those women may have needed.
Yeah. I love both of those points. I want to jump back to something because you were talking about how euphoric it must have felt for her, where when June was able to unleash on Aunt Lydia and like just really lean into to like telling her captor what she thought. And the same thing with Serena, where she was almost crazed. And it was so gratifying to watch that sort of sense of catharsis that she undoubtedly felt when in the beginning or the very, very first scene when she's cutting her hair. And that should have been an amazing, glorious feeling for her. We saw it in the Boston Globe episode where, like, when she did cut her hair, she was just like, yes, the sense of relief, shedding this physical, like, reminder. And when we see it in the beginning of this episode, it does nothing for her in that same sort of transformative sense. We've talked before about how June is, like, almost struggling with this addiction to getting back at Gilead. And she's chasing that same high. She's chasing that high of getting to really teach these people, like, and show them how fucking awful they are. And like, I'm lacking the words, but I think, like, Scarlett, you made a face. You understand where I'm going with
this. I know
this.
Exactly what you're doing. I get it. I do.
It's never going to be good enough. She's always going to be chasing like that feeling of like really just, how can she bring down Serena? How can she bring down Fred? How can she bring down Lydia? How can she bring down Gilead? And that's like, I feel like that's one of the reasons that like she's like, she was really pushing for these girls to have that same sort of experience, because she knows how good it can feel, but she's not recognizing that like it can be dangerous to continue down that path.
Yeah. How do you top that rush? I mean, the fact that she got it once with Aunt Lydia is surprising. The fact that she got it twice with Serena. Now I feel like she's just going to keep looking for it. And that is the trajectory that we're going to see her on.
Because she gets it a third time, too, in the courtroom scene when she gets to look at Fred and say, I am done. I am done.
I understand how that could be a thing that you want to keep feeling again and again. Yeah. I really do get it. I have had that experience once. I do it again. It was fucking great.
Absolutely.
I have that experience every time. I'm going to give you a movie reference, so brace yourselves. Every time I watch Law Abiding Citizens, it's like one of my favorite movies ever. And it's because I am so massively fueled by the idea of revenge. Like, that opening scene in that movie is the most horrific thing my mind could ever imagine, much like Handmaid's Tale. And the rest of the movie is this man seeking his own justice and all the ways in which it goes terribly wrong. And it doesn't even bother me. I'm like, nah, good enough. He's got a goal and he's got to get to these people and he's killing innocent people. And I'm still like, well, he had a point to prove. And that movie like really, really messed me up, because I was like, I didn't realize I was such a vengeful person. And that's what I feel when I see June in all of these situations, is like, I get why it's not a great thing for her to be chasing this. And it's like, I don't even logically care, because it just feels so good to me.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
Chasing the high of that gratification and
yeah,
I love it.
Okay, so then as June and Moira are talking about the healing process, Emily is being stalked by this woman that she doesn't want to have anything to do with. And she just wants to talk to Emily. June is very protective of Emily. And this woman is very insistent. She drops a piece of paper as well. Emily does not want to talk about who this woman is. She is very, very hesitant to say anything about her. And Emily goes, Moira follows. And this is another situation where June, again, like, she takes that leadership role, because she's the one that makes the woman go away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she steps in between them and Emily, and she stands up for her friend.
What really jumped out at me before you even get to the scene where the woman shows up, where you have Moira and June talking in the bookshelves, right? And behind them, you can see where the support group was, right? There's all the chairs there, and you still see the handmade lamps. And one of the things that I forgot to say about the support group with those handmade lamps, at first I said there's four, and it makes a box as they're showing like the aerial view. And then as everyone's talking about June and her experience, and no one's even letting her speak, like you're saying, she gets more and more isolated. And as the camera pans into her face, you have four more handmade lamps behind her. And now it's just June and one little handmade lamp box by herself while everyone else talks about experiences in which she can't relate. And then her first words are to tell them that she can't relate to anything they're saying. She doesn't agree with any of it. It very much set her apart and alone in her own little Gilead box. And then that same box that she was in this scene where the aunt and with the Aunt Irene and Emily show up and have this interaction. The first shot you see is them walking directly into that same little like four handmade light box. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like Emily can't get out of the box either. And now she's being confronted and she doesn't want to be there. It's very clear that this is not a confrontation she's comfortable with and she'd rather step away from it and not see it at all. And this woman's making it very difficult for her. And that's what I love about June is she just instantly kicks it into gear. Of, nope, not here. You don't. Even before like her security detail, she's supposed to have a security detail and like he don't give a shit about this woman and Emily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, his subject is June. Yeah. Fuck Emily.
Yeah. But I feel like this irate woman in the library should be concerning, period.
I know. Agreed, right? Entirely.
Or like anxious. I don't think she was irate, but she was definitely jittery.
Well, she was definitely insistent.
Yeah.
Persistent.
Absolutely.
June stopped her in her tracks, and I thought it was so cool.
Mm-hmm. June stops her in her tracks, but then June is also equally as obstinate when it comes to like questioning Emily at the dinner table. It's like, who this woman is?
Whew. Yeah, huh?
It's absolutely wild because like they're trying to have a nice dinner. Emily's talking about returning to school, maybe going back. Syl is very supportive like of her returning to her teaching career. And then June just out of nowhere, who's Iris Baker?
So like, but it wasn't out of nowhere to me. This is the scene that really offended me for June. I was upset for June in this scene because you have the three people that she's probably closest with in Canada, right? And no one at all can acknowledge her experiences. It's like even like I almost can get it from Luke because at least he's so far removed. But obviously Moira and Emily have been out for a while and they've had time to adjust. But I feel like no one's accepting the fact that June has very much not had time to adjust. And she maybe doesn't want to sit around the table talking about how everyone has plans to move forward because we know. And maybe it's unfair because it's only us that knows that June's head is very much still in Gilead at all times. She is dealing with all of that trauma, all of those flashbacks that we get to see her have constantly. But like she to sit there and listen to Moira talk about what she wants to do and what, you know, she's coding and boot camp and plans and moving forward. And then you've got Emily, like Luke questions her, do you want to go back to teaching? And she's talking about how she's not ready, but Syl's kind of pushing her. Again, it's these people that are more further removed from the situation, pushing her to go back into teaching. And she's saying, well, I don't know if I'm ready yet. And to me, I'm like, well, is anyone going to acknowledge that there's, I just feel like for June, it feels like they're all trying to move on with their life. And she's like, what about stopping Gilead? Which I understand is an obsession for her, but it's also a valid point. And she's very much entrenched in everything that's there. And it's still on Canadian soil. She's got to testify tomorrow. Like, there's just so much happening. And for them to just be like, so Emily, are you going to go back to teaching anytime soon? That's like, it's, I don't know. I thought it wasn't very fair to June to be having that flippant conversation like that.
I can totally see where you're coming from with this because perhaps they could be a bit more sensitive to what June's about to be going through. My inclination for how this scene went, though, was similar, but like, of course, I'm going to view it slightly differently because that's what you and I do. I viewed it as June feeling alienated in her healing process, not necessarily because these people are being insensitive to her, but because they're at a different point of their healing process and she's still very much in that very raw stage. And with her pulling the attention back onto who Iris Baker is, and there's this awkward silence that they all have, and Emily doesn't really want to talk about this, and June saying, you should face her, and Emily saying, we're not all like you, I think is her way of trying to say, like, we're not all in the same part of our healing process. And I can definitely see where you're coming from with them not being particularly fair to June about this, but it's also, I mean, again, June is a trauma victim right now. She is dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. She's dealing with the stress of everything else. But I just feel like maybe like when Emily says, we're not all like you, that would have been June's opportunity to say like, okay, cool. Like I need to process this though. Like, so, and yeah. Like, do you think maybe it's perhaps that she doesn't feel safe having that conversation around Luke or around anyone at this point? Or is it?
I think she's more insistent with Emily because I feel like her and Emily have enough shared experiences where I almost feel like she's pleading for the Emily she knows to come back. And that's what I guess is probably the biggest part of this scene is the fact that Moira's talking about going back to the career we know she was already working on pre-Gilead. Emily is being asked if she's going back to the career. Like, think about it for a second. If you're June in this moment, are you thinking about going back to editing? Like, is that even kind of a thought in your mind? So like, alienated, 100%, I agree with you. If nothing else, like, it might not be fair to say they're being insensitive, but it certainly to June feels at least a little insensitive, certainly alienating. And I feel like it's almost her pleading because she doesn't take her eyes off Emily. It's creepy. It is creepy. She stares at Emily the entire time they're having like boot camp coding conversation. Like it's awkward from the start. She's just intensely staring at her. And then she starts to question her, but then Luke jumps in with like outrage. And that was frustrating to me because again, I'm like, they just are so far removed from her immediate experiences. And I feel like, yeah, you're right. It's just that she's incredibly alienated in this scene.
Yeah. This to me felt like a very similar to how in the last episode where June held Luke down to get what she wanted out of him, which was at that point, like a sexual release. This to me, like with June staring at Emily and not releasing her gaze, felt very much mentally in that same sort of vibe of like making the person that she's directing her attention towards extremely uncomfortable with her intensity and not being willing to relinquish that perhaps what she's doing might not be the best of options. And it might be a bit abrasive, a bit uncouth. That's sort of what it felt like to me at that moment as well, was that same sort of like violation of the person who she's talking to, sovereignty over themselves, if that makes sense.
It does. It really does. But it makes me think about the fact that, so what if there's nothing else that Emily and June can do, is that they can communicate without talking. They've had to, right? For so long, they had to be able to communicate with just their looks. And I'm wondering if that's part of it too, that alienation that she's feeling. And that, like I was saying, it feels like she's pleading with her, and it's certainly uncomfortable. But what if it's because she doesn't even want to talk about it with Luke right there. Like you're saying, like she asked her about it and then he quickly like, oh, June, why would you say, like, why would you ask her that? Yeah. He's so like appalled by it. And she's like, almost doesn't even have time for his question. She's like, it's aunts. That's what they do. They hurt people. I'm trying to get an answer right now. Like Luke seemed to be annoying her. His presence seemed to be annoying her. His questions seemed to be annoying her. But also I think that she was trying to communicate with Emily by staring at her because they can do that without their words.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It also like plays into what we see later in the episode where June is just not willing to communicate with Luke. So she has these massive, like a massive fortress around her when it comes to discussing anything about Gilead with Luke. And this is very much a Gilead conversation that she's trying to have with Emily. And Luke's interjections must feel like a bit of an affront to her.
I think this conversation would have gone differently if Luke wasn't there. For sure. I think that they would have probably spoken more plainly about this. But bottom line, like, I understand June's feelings of alienation, but she's not understanding boundaries either.
Yeah, right.
Emily has some boundaries right now, and Moira calls her on it because she says, what does it matter? Because Emily here doesn't want to talk about it. And it's like, yeah, exactly. Let her eat.
Yeah. That's interesting because I feel like a lot of June's experiences have probably shaded boundaries. You know what I mean? We see it a lot. Boundaries don't really exist anywhere for her or for anyone else in Gilead. So it's almost like we're seeing a lot of that play out where she's like, you know, she says it later, like, apparently I need to ask your opinion or see it. You know what I mean? She kind of makes this comment like, that's how we do things now. But it's like, yeah, that is how we do things now, June. Welcome to Canada.
Well, we've talked about it before. Conversational style in Gilead doesn't allow for long, drawn-out, elaborative discussions about how we're going to go from point A to point B. You have to get from point A to point B in three sentences or less. And if you want something, you got to state it quickly because this might be your last fucking chance. So I feel like she is definitely still in, I'm in resistance fighter mode, and we have to communicate short, quick, and to the point all the time, right now. Even though I'm not in Gilead anymore, I don't necessarily have to do that.
Right.
She's still stuck in it. She's still stuck in a war zone.
All that trauma. Absolutely. The anxiety. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. So the next scene, which isn't really a scene, it's wine glass washing time after dinner, a routine that is familiar around these parts. And the conversation between Luke and June goes super well. This is a time where I feel like June may have been minimizing Emily's experience with the aunt, or maybe the other experiences of the other women, because she says, how bad could she be? Aunt Lydia set a high fucking bar. And Luke, again, goes back to that boundary crossing. Well, if Emily wanted you to know, she would have just told you, right? Yeah. All right, Luke, I get it. But passive aggressiveness is not going to fly with her. Just be fucking direct. She had enough passive aggressiveness with Serena. Just be direct, Luke. And that's where we find out that Luke did his own boundary crossing because he told Twello about June's lake house story. And June is pissed. And I don't blame her. I do understand why he told Twello, because it is his daughter and this is information that he wants this guy to have because it may be helpful. But June sees it as, that was my story to tell, and I didn't get that far in the story, and you just went ahead and did it for me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, hypocritical of June to be pissed off about this, but I do understand why she was upset. Bottom line, like, this is one of those things, like, the victim should be allowed to tell their story. Unless the victim isn't around to tell their story, you allow the victim to tell their story in their own way, in their own time.
Right. And we haven't really seen June say a lot of it, and we certainly are going to watch her do a lot more name dropping in her testimony. But at the same time, I feel like it's another highlight of the fact that Luke and her are very out of touch with their, at least each other's experiences, or he's out of touch with her experience, because she has had to operate under this very stealth and underground network for so long. Like, this information, for me, is a lot of the things she's saying are not necessarily things that she wants out or wants in Twello's hands. Like I was saying before, I don't know if I trust him to like have all of this information. So, and we know that she's at least still thinking about Nick. When she had that moment with Nicole, she acknowledged Nick, acknowledged that he's the one that got her there. And, or maybe that was just me putting my own thoughts into that scene. I don't think she actually acknowledged that part of it. But, you know, he's at least on her mind. And a lot of that information could get people, specifically Nick, in a lot of trouble. And for Luke to be like offering it up again, I understand why he went to it and probably didn't think anything of it. But just another red flag for June of like, she can't trust him. She can't. He doesn't understand her. She's alone in her experiences once again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely see where you two are coming from with that, because shocker, different point of view. When I saw this, June was very annoyed at Luke for bringing up the lake house to Twello. And hearing you two talk about it, I'm willing to shift my perspective. But my original perspective was that perhaps like Luke was just trying to give as much information to Twello as possible about finding his daughter. But also perhaps it wouldn't occur to him that this would be sensitive information, because June hasn't expressed to him that this is sensitive information, because she hasn't talked about any of her experiences with Gilead. Any time that anything is brought up, she just completely shuts down that portion of the conversation. And also, I'm willing to venture a guess that Luke meant no disrespect for disclosing the information to Twello. I'm sure it was done completely innocently, because we have seen, like in the last episode, we saw Luke be so extremely respectful of her boundaries, giving her the space that she needed in the bathroom, sleeping on the couch, being respectful of just like her boundaries regarding touch and like any other sort of emotional boundary that she seems to have in play. So I was a bit more sympathetic to Luke in this regard, because like for him, I don't think that there was any ill intent there, and he wasn't trying to like go around her or anything like that, because how could he know what the boundary is when she's not expressing what the boundary is, because she's not communicating with him at all. So I understand why she would be so annoyed at him, because it is her story to tell, and being the victim, we should always allow the victim to tell the story in their own time. I just don't think that like for her to be so harsh to him and so cold to him, I don't think is understanding that like he has been so patient with her with all these boundaries, and there was no ill intent meant there.
I agree with you there. I do. I don't think that he thought he was doing anything wrong. I'm sure that he thought he was being super helpful. If he didn't know, he didn't know.
Right. And it actually is even highlighted in the conversation, because I thought when he says, well, if Emily wanted you to know, she would have told you, right? To me, I thought that was him really kind of reassuring himself. Like, this is probably something he tells himself all the time. If June wants him to know, she will tell him because she's not giving him any information. She's not telling him anything about they are obviously not communicating well. So I completely agree with you. I think he tries to do the best he can through this whole episode. And that's what's so heartbreaking, is that he just genuinely doesn't know what she needs, and he's trying to figure it out, but she's not giving him a lot to go on. And also, like, it's kind of exhausting to me to even, like, hear you talk about, like, oh, well, she's not really giving him a lot of, like, understanding or leeway or, like, anything. Because I'm just like, oh, she's got so much to deal with. She doesn't have to deal with breaking his feelings right now.
No, she doesn't have to. And, like, that's definitely, like, she is the victim of insane abuse and trauma. And she should – it's not her place or responsibility to to help him through her trauma.
Exactly.
Is ultimately what it comes down to.
I do think she feels kind of exhausted by that idea.
Yeah. I mean, granted, like I said, though, I'm willing to grant Luke a little bit of levity, though, because, again, he's shown that he is so respectful of her boundaries and tries to do everything he can to do what is going to be best for her in every circumstance they have. So, like, I understand her frustration, but I'm also just like, he's trying.
Yeah. He's trying. He is. I agree with you completely.
Hey, another thing, too, that we need to think about is in the last episode, June pretty much raped him.
Yeah. Oh, she absolutely did.
She raped him. Okay? I just can't imagine how Luke must be feeling in this episode. She must be a complete stranger to him right now.
Yeah, she is.
So that's no wonder that he doesn't know how to proceed or what to do, because June has done her own boundary crossing with him. And he has got to be, and he probably didn't know how to react, because he's like, well, she just got home, like, and I just got her. I don't want to lose her again. Right. Like, I mean, he's going through his own special mind fuck right now. So,
oh, for sure.
He's not going to, people are going to make mistakes. This is, man, they're going to fuck this up real good. I can feel it.
Yeah, like,
I feel like this is the episode that was really, like, sending clear signs to all is not well here.
Yeah.
I mean, Moira does go to bat for June to a point when she walks in, because she really senses that there's something super awkward going on. And Luke confesses to her that he doesn't know what to do. She's like a stranger, and they just talk about Hannah, and then there's bed. And Moira tells him, like, trauma sucks. It's a bumpy road. Like, you got to be patient until she gets wherever it is that she's going to be. And he's like, well, you know, I would probably get this more if she'd fucking tell me what she's been through. And then June is standing in the stairwell hearing all of this, which I'm glad that she did, because I don't know if the ending would have happened if she didn't.
I'm inclined to agree with you on that. Yeah. And like him saying that I don't know what she wants, and like hearing him get choked up, and then hearing Moira, I say that, like, getting over trauma is a bumpy fucking road. We need to be patient until June gets where she's going. You don't know what she's gone through. And Luke saying, like, maybe that's the problem. I think that's an accurate assertion. It's like one of the key components of helping someone through their trauma is to at least have an understanding of what they went through, so you can be empathetic towards their situation. Like when you're in that close of a proximity to them. I have a light theory that I want to go through too. While Moira was talking, though, and saying that, like, going through trauma is a bumpy fucking road, there were what looked like three very fuzzy lights behind her. And at first I was like, yeah, whatever, lights. And then I, like, hit the brakes. I was like, wait a second, Scarlett talked about light theory and mentioned that we should be looking at this. And I started to rabbit hole the way that Marjorie does. And I rewound and realized that in the dinner scene, you have Emily and Moira on one side and Luke and June on the other, and there's three lights that are hanging. Then behind Moira, you have those three fuzzy lights. And there's so many other circumstances where we see three lights throughout this. And I think that this is like them just kind of subtly driving a point home of, like, these interactions between our core trios are so important, and we're going to have a constant focus on this. Like, the relationship between Moira, June, and Luke is obviously, it's a constant, but, like, just something to keep an eye on. You also have Serena, Fred, and June, and, like, all of these interactions between these three, like, there's always a trio of people that, like, we tend to have a focus on. So I kept noticing, like, lights popping up in groups of three.
Oh, that's cool.
So I've noticed that before. Is it three circle lights?
Yes.
Okay. So here's the thing. So I sent you the screenshots, right?
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking about too, because, but I thought that what they were pointing towards is the fact that like June is always going to be in that Gilead box, because the one pick was from June in the box at Gilead Gitmo. And she's like peering through those holes and we see them. And every time they're in the goddamn kitchen, those three circular lights pop up again, or three circular hole-like lights. I don't know how to put them. They're obviously lights or reflections. That's how we see it. But there was another episode two, maybe it was the last one, I think, where they were sitting at the kitchen table and you see those same three lights again.
Mm-hmm.
Right next to their face, right off in the distance. So to me, that was telling me that June can't get out of that box.
Yeah.
She's still that. In it. They're all going to have it in them in some way.
I love all those thoughts. That's so cool.
Yeah.
It kind of goes down. So we were talking before we recorded too, and I don't know if this will be a valid thought once the episodes come out, because I'm not entirely sure that it's going to be in the real episodes and not just in the screeners that we've seen. So the screeners have like little minor editing things, and it says these are not for final viewing or airing. And it's clear because there's like line changes and like little cool notes and things that I really adore seeing.
Yeah, it's super cool.
It is very cool.
Like this little glimpse that you get into filmmaking, that's just like really fascinating for us.
They're like, oh, we're going to add in like Luke saying something right here. And I'm add like, more he's smoke. Not even saying it in the scene, and they're just going to have it over. And, like, that's so cool. But later when June is testifying, very, very well lit, natural lit light. And there's these orbs floating around. And I just don't know if they're even going to be in the actual final scene, or if they're going to edit them out, or if they're supposed to be there. But it does kind of play in, like, I kept thinking, like, at one point it's like straight on her forehead and it like freaks me out because it looks like that gun scope.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it could also be like you were saying, of like if she's still in the box and like the light is shining through just like on her forehead, like it kind of gives that same feeling. But I'm just not convinced that those are even going to be there in the final. So we'll see.
We shall see.
We shall see. But the next scene even has a little bit of those three lights in it. Serena reading through something or other, and immediately, like, she's standing up again, or she's standing next to her giant, gorgeous, like, floor-to-ceiling picture window. It's raining outside, and there's three lights that are shining on the wall right outside of her window, which for me made for a nice visual transition. And Fred enters with all of these platitudes, and nope, Serena's just hanging out reading Moira's affidavit.
I love this so much because it is so clear that Serena wears the pants in the family. Mm-hmm. She's reading, I guess, I don't know if it was like from the, is it an affidavit or a newspaper? I don't even know.
It is an affidavit because she says, Moira gives quite the compelling testimony, or like quite the compelling affidavit, something to that effect.
Fred's sexual tastes were very pedestrian. On occasion, he couldn't even perform. When that happened, he'd make me have sex with another Jezebel while he watched and masturbated. And a good morning to you, Fred Snuckley says. She's a deviant and a liar, and I am really appreciating the shit out of Joseph Fine's voice here. It's not as gravelly as it was in previous episodes. I feel like that means that Fred's on an upswing. I don't want Fred to be on an upswing.
Right.
But I just feel like he's feeling good about things. Fred, that overconfident piece of shit that he is. Mm-hmm. I mean, Serena makes a point, though. The judges aren't going to think so. They're not going to think that she's a deviant and a liar. And, you know, you rolling your eyes in the court footage didn't help you at all. And that she wants him to call her June. Why? Because optics matter.
Yeah. I was saying that last episode. I'm like, what if he keeps calling her Offred? He's such a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm. Because he genuinely believes it. Because he genuinely doesn't think he has done anything wrong.
Because Fred is the human personification of misogyny and male chauvinism. Mm-hmm. That's why. Fred knows how to get under her skin, though. He really does know how to say the same thing. I feel like when he was saying appearances matter, Mrs. Waterford, when he was, you know, bitching at her for not coming to court, I felt like he was channeling like the guys in The Matrix when he said that, you know, the sunglasses guys, the way that he said it, it was in just the same tone and the same delivery. And I was like, you are so creepy and robotic, Fred. Mm-hmm. Yes, you are. That gets under Serena's skin because, I mean, do you want June to think you are afraid to face her?
Perfect thing to say to her right then. I'm like, damn, Fred, you're good.
He is good. Truly. He is really good. And also, I don't know if she was chagrined by the fact that he used the line about the teal dress on her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ooh, maybe wear the teal. I don't know if she was just like, you rascally devil, how do you do that? Or if that was her feeling like, it's kind of hot that he said that. I don't know. Because I'm getting those feelings of how it used to be for them when they used to work together back in the day, when they did have that connection once upon a time. And this is what I imagine their back and forth would have looked like. We've only gotten little glimpses of it here and there throughout the series. And I'm just kind of enjoying seeing it again. Even though I fucking hate them, I do enjoy seeing their back and forth. It's very easy to see how they worked well together once upon a time.
I think that was the look on her face, was that she also enjoyed that. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's what she felt it was, because, and it, we always know, like, with the three lights, we know it's always been this weird triangle.
Yeah.
Of Fred, Serena, and June. And he has always pitted them against each other and tried to make them, you know, he rewards June when Serena is mean to her. And then he throws it in Serena's face when he wants to get it. You know, like, he's yes. always using these two women to get what he wants. And he's doing the same thing. And that's what I think Serena was almost picking up on. But I feel like she was happy about it because it was the first time he wanted her back on his team. Like, he usually uses it to put Serena down. And this time, it feel like it was a little bit more like, come over on my side because this big mean girl's going to come hurt me. And you should be mad at her too. Like, you know,
I think I read why she liked it in a different way.
I don't know why. I'm just guessing as you're talking.
Oh,
about
no,
it.
I don't know.
I have just, zero idea.
I'm guessing that she just kind of likes that. Like, you know, oh, wear the teal. That is such a 1950s husband thing to say to your wife when your boss is coming over for a dinner party.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
And Serena and all her homemaking wifely glory that, and she's pregnant too, to boot. Like, this is like, she loves that shit. I could completely see her getting off on that particular type of wordplay. I don't know.
I get it. I totally see what you're saying. I thought you meant she was getting off on the fact that, like, he was using, like, the Gilead. Like that was an old come on from before. Like, the only reason the wives wear teal is because it looked good on Serena and he told her once. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh God.
Definitely.
So I thought you were saying it like that. And I was like, oh, I can see it, but that's not
and
really where I went.
And we shall wear teal.
Yeah, exactly. And she was just like, it's always been my color. You know, like, it's so true that that's how that probably did play out.
Almost certainly.
I thought you were saying it like that, but I see what you're saying. And yeah, I could totally see her being like being totally into those, like, typical husband-wife roles of, like,
yeah.
I'm going to tell you what to wear and you just be that pretty little thing on my arm.
Oh, that's right, honey. And I will absolutely go vacuum those floors in my high heels. That's Serena.
Exactly. 100%.
If Serena did things like vacuumed floors.
If Serena did things like vacuum floors. See, how I saw this was, like, I definitely saw that saying that, like, she was enjoying it. But I saw that she was enjoying it less because, like, hey, now we're back to our old banter, and more, like, the whole, like, you should wear the teal, and that sort of, like, weird kind of smile comes across her face is because she's the one reminding him about the optics, and she's like, you need to start calling her June. And then when Fred retorts with that, he's thinking about the optics, and she's like, now we're on the same page again.
Oh, I like that.
It's more her being satisfied that, like, that now he is playing along with her.
Right.
As
yeah.
well. And
that's
like, yes,
great
he's
point.
Standing up to her in his own way and, like, trying to manipulate the power back into his position. But ultimately, they're back on the same team as far as those optics are concerned. And she is very gratified that she was able to get him to think about the optics again and stop being so fucking selfish.
And I think she's also gratified that it's June that they're against. You know what I mean? Like, I think that she's got, especially after the last scene that we've seen them in together, like, I think that the way that they're kind of two sides of the same coin, we know June is fueled by rage and revenge at this point. And I feel like Serena is 100% going to be the same way.
Absolutely.
Okay, so new scene. It's Arjuna Hall time, and we got handmaids on the floor, on the windows, making the place look spick and span until Aunt Lydia comes in and ruins everything.
She pulled a real Serena here.
Oh, she really fucking did. Wow, man. She's schooling handmaids on how to properly wash floors, and Aunt Ruth and Elizabeth are standing over there laughing at her, which I would too, because fuck you, Aunt Lydia. But Lydia knows. Lydia, you know when somebody's talking about you. You get it. And Lydia is not stupid. She picks up on it, too. And gossip is a tool of the devil's, ladies.
Aunt Ruth responds, "We were just saying what a blessing it is to have you back, Aunt Lydia." And Aunt Lydia says, "A blessing? Aren't you kind? But we must set a good example, mustn't we?" And then she, like, rages on Kylie.
Hi, Carly. For... missed a spot.
Well, Carly missed a spot, but she mouths back to Lydia. And that's what does her in. If she had just said, "I'm so sorry," or "I'll scrub it again, thank you for pointing it out to me," something like that.
Or said nothing at all and kept scrubbing.
Or said nothing at all.
Yep. Just try harder.
Exactly. Those would have been the elegant solution. But the whole, but looking at Aunt Lydia and saying, "I think it's a stain," or "I think it's a spot," like, wrong response, wrong response. And she learned that very quickly. Talking back to anyone in a position of power in Gilead is going to inevitably lead to some sort of punishment. And Carly had to learn that the hard way by being at the wrong end of a cattle prod. And so did Aunt Ruth.
So did Aunt Ruth. Like, okay, things we care about in this episode. Optics, Lydia. Lydia has not figured out optics of how she can appear powerful and in control without actually channeling a bad look.
Yeah, because nothing about that seemed in control.
I was embarrassed for her in this. It sucks for Ruth. Actually, no, fuck Ruth. She deserved
fuck
it.
Ruth, right?
It sucks for Carly that she had to be on the receiving end of Aunt Lydia's insecurity. Mm-hmm. But it's a bad, bad look. It was embarrassing for her. And I think it's really because, you know, we know the Aunt Lydia that we've seen in the last several episodes. And we know the Aunt Lydia that we're going to get to know in the Testaments. And we know what an incredibly, like, polished, smooth operator she is in the Testaments. And so to see her in this in-between time and, like, fumbling in that way, just really, there's going to be an abuse of power, but I just don't think this was the hill that she needed to die on to try to exert her authority and to try to look good for the other aunts. She fucked it up so bad, and I loved it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Carly. That sucked for you. But I loved seeing her make an ass out of herself.
Oh, yeah. I love the last shot, too, before she walks out as Ruth and, is it Carly? I thought it was Kylie. Carly. You've got the handmaid and you've got Ruth lying and, like, on the ground, basically. And Lydia is underneath the chandelier and she just kind of, like, looks around and she just looks like the queen of pain and destruction. And I don't think that's the optic she's going for. I think it's like she realizes as she looks there, she's like, "Oh shit, I fucked up." And then she just beelines it for the door, like, "Oh, I'll just pretend this was totally meant to be." But yeah, you're right. She's just not in control at all. And it's a lot that it's not the first time we've seen her like this. This is something that keeps happening. She did it with Janine when she, like, lashed out at her, like, so unnecessarily. And it was like, whoa, that was an overreaction to, like, the one person who kind of likes you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, we've been seeing her falter since season 3, and this is just a continuation of that. It's interesting how she seemed like she was so secure for so long. And it's really roughly, like, this last year, we could actually figure out that it's been at least a year since she was assaulted by Emily and since she's had all these, like, you know, issues ever since. But like I said, it's embarrassing to me. I can't stand Aunt Lydia, but it makes me feel uncomfortable to see her flounder because mm-hmm. she's usually your rock as much as she fucking sucks, she's the one that you can pretty much like count on for a relatively like solid presentation.
Yeah.
Right.
So when she's out of control, it's scary.
You want her to get it together, but it's also kind of gratifying watch her not be able to keep her shit together. Mm-hmm. And watching her flounder as she comes to grips with the notion that she did lose her power for a moment, and now she has some power back, but she's still sort of like the object of disdain from both the handmaids and from her fellow aunts. Like, she doesn't have a sense of community, and it is kind of gratifying watching her be a bit of a temperamental brat about that.
She's alone, and I think it's interesting how her story parallels June.
Absolutely.
June also doesn't fit in where she's at right now either. So the next scene is pretty much our main event of this episode. It's June testifying. And we see her initially sitting, looking very alone with a single piece of paper in her lap, and some sort of judge approaches her to tell her that it's time. And we hear her heartbeat very loud, and then we see her walk down the hall, and the only thing that we hear is a click of her heels as the doors open to this grand courtroom.
Before she goes in, though, when she's sitting there on that bench, they do that thing with the light where half of her face is in the light and half is in the shadows. And I thought it was really cool. Right before the guy walks up to tell her he's ready, she's just sitting there. And it just is a very good representation of exactly where her head's at right now. Of she can't really fully step into the light when she's so plagued by the shadows of her very near past. And I love how as she's walking down to enter, first of all, you see that box again of the doors just look very much like it's this box that she's going to enter. But instead, when she opens up the doors, it's this giant, well-lit, beautiful dome. Like, you couldn't step into more natural light. Everything about this room is curved. Like, the seats are arranged in a circle. And then I'm like, wow, there's circles everywhere. And I was like, oh my gosh, she's finally not in Gilead. She can finally step into this natural light and speak her truth. And then the first thing she does is step into a witness stand. It's a total box. I'm like, oh, this girl cannot get out of these boxes. She can't. She's got to stand in this box while she gives this testimony. It makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what Serena was thinking right here. Because I don't actually care what Fred was thinking. But Serena, I feel like she, on some level, has always been kind of hidden to us as far as these, like, real human connections go. Because we know that she's terrible at them. And we know that she has had these real human connections with June in the past. And I don't doubt for a minute that Serena didn't know that June was right.
Yeah.
In their last meeting. I don't know. I was very curious to figure out what the hell Serena could have been feeling listening to this testimony, because we know that she 100% wouldn't have seen any of it like that. But I do believe that afterwards she would have. Fred certainly didn't.
Right.
No.
But then also Luke showed up, even though June told him not to. And all I could think was, wow, buddy, you asked for it.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Yeah.
I was actually pretty pleased to see him there because it felt like an overstep. It felt like it was crossing a boundary that June wasn't ready to let him cross yet. Absolutely. And in that regard, like, I don't want to say it's unforgivable, but that's going to be difficult for her to get through and get over, and the fact that he effectively disregarded her wishes. However, I'm glad that it ended up being taken the way that it did, where Luke was just like, no, I need to understand what you're going through. And this is an opportunity for me to get to experience it. So you don't have to rehash it another time. And I can start to see all of your points of trauma and start to have a better understanding of you without you having to relive it yet another time for me. I think it was a very brave choice for him to do that. to walk in with Twello as well, like sort of like that felt kind of dirty and desolate. Ooh, Marjorie disagrees.
Oh, I thought you were going the same place, but apparently we weren't. Never mind. I was like nodding and I was shaking my head in agreement with you.
No, you were shaking your head no.
I was shaking my head no, but I thought she was going to say the thing I was thinking. So I was like, agree. I was disgusted with you. And then I wasn't, because apparently you're not disgusted by that. But
oh, no, I'm interested to see what you think I was going to say. But I'm just going to like, I'll stop with that thought, because I'm just like, I really appreciated that Luke was willing to put himself into that position and say, like, I'm going to listen to your trauma. I am here for you. You might have this wall up. It's basically almost felt like him extending an olive branch to her. I didn't think it was like super great that she saw him, because it definitely could have shaken her and affected her testimony, which was a very trepidatious thing to do. And that's why, like, when I saw him walk in, like him walk in with Twello, I was like, what the actual fuck? Like, you should be waiting in the galley somewhere, like somewhere in hidden spots. That way you're not disrupting her. But then that would have felt disingenuous too, because then it would have been like him sneaking around and peering in on a part of herself that she wanted to keep private from him. So I don't know what would have been the better option here if he had... Oh, go ahead. Tell it. What do you think is the better option? Him just staying home?
Talk to her before he shows up. Like I agree that he should have been there, and I agree that he should have said all the things he said after the fact. But, I mean, to walk in moments before she's about to take the stand and have to read this testimony, like, that's just very, like, fucked up mentally for her. So, like, when you said brave, I was like, wait, what? That's not brave. That was, like, stupid. And then when you said the Twello part, that's what I thought you were going to say. Like, maybe it was stupid that he walked in with Twello, because it just makes this entrance where it's like he couldn't have already been seated. He had to, like, make that entrance, right? Because it rattled me to watch her watch that. So, that's the part that I had the biggest issue with. So, like, in a perfect world, I agree that he should have been there. And I agree that it was good for him to explain why he should be there, because he should be able to hear everything she's went through, because he's never going to be able to understand if he can't hear it. But A, it sounds like this is all something that he could read about later. So he didn't necessarily have to be in the room to understand what she went through. But I understand if he wanted to, like, support her and be there for her and tell her, like, nothing you say is ever going to make me change the way I see you or anything like that. But it should have been a conversation before, although obviously their communication sucks. Like I didn't have massive issues with it, but it was just a little bit like, ugh, really? But whatever. I mean, once he was there and she started, I was like, wow, I'm glad he's hearing this, specifically the part when she explains why she didn't leave.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So this was roughly like 6 minutes worth of monologue. It was a lot. And obviously, we're not going to go through all of it. But what I liked about all of this is that her testimony was very simple and factual.
Yeah.
Bare bones. There is no complication of emotions or circumstances, because the actual facts are bad enough. And the fact that she doesn't get into the psychological torture aspect of it, that's what's missing from all of this. Like, she can lay this out for the court and Luke can hear it, but it's still just not even going to scratch the surface of what she's been through for the last 7 years. I found it interesting that she did get choked up a little bit about Serena's finger. She does say, I had an opportunity to escape, but I couldn't leave my daughter behind. So there, you haters. Mm-hmm. And then
and
she gets
Luke.
And Luke. She gets choked up over Eleanor. I didn't realize that the last time that she saw Fred was when they made Lawrence rape her. Mm-hmm. That just kind of escaped me. Right around the 21-minute mark, I really felt like she was speaking to all of us. The way that she was looking at the camera and her delivery, that's how I felt. You know, my friends who've lost their lives, who can never be heard, it is for those women that I ask the ICC to confirm the charges again. At this man, I ask for the maximum possible sentence. I ask for justice. I feel like she was speaking to everybody. And that was the purpose of this, to speak to people in a more general sense, to have compassion for people who are victims. Because in Gilead, as elsewhere.
Yeah.
It was very powerful the way she delivered it.
It felt like her way of healing and dealing with all the guilt that we've been talking about that she's had for so long. And now she's in Canada. And it's like, do you want to sit in a support group and talk about journaling? Or do you want to actually make all of this worth something And I feel like this was her way of being like, look, yeah, I'm here, but I didn't forget how I got here. And I'm not the only, and just because I'm here doesn't change the fact that there aren't people going through this right now. There are my friends that have died to get me here. Like, I feel like that was a lot of her taking that weight off of her shoulders in the first step of healing. I just felt like that was her way of dealing with all that. And to make it such a public statement was something that June very specifically would need in that situation, that the support group will never give her.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah, that public declaration of women, my friends who lost their lives, their voices can never be heard, I think was a critical part to her healing, because Iowa and Janine had brought that to her and like had tried to hold that mirror up to her face. June was, I mean, understandably so. She was just like, I'm doing everything I can. And I also should have left you behind. Like, she was a little embittered about it. Like, the tensions were running high. But in this moment, she's acknowledging that those women lost their lives. So that way she could be there and she could be speaking out against the atrocities. There's two other things that really jumped out in this as far as like the actual language that she used. So the first was, she was posted with the Waterfords in 2017. So that means that the timeline that we're keeping with like the release of the with the release of the episodes and the release of each season is kind of keeping in the timeline of present day.
Yeah.
That was kind of nice for grounding it in the real world. When they started talking about the ceremony, three successive nights every month while ovulating.
I didn't know it was three.
No, we didn't. Nope. It makes so much sense. I feel like we've talked about that it was stupid to have it as one night, not that we want three consecutive nights, but it's like, why would they like magically know? Obviously, that even if they do some kind, like we've just talked about how one night a month isn't really going to cut it. And apparently they agree. Ugh, three nights in a row. My God, that makes it three times more awful, obviously.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, my word, how is the suicide rate not 100% with these handmaids? Like, I can't fucking fathom the mental fortitude you would have to be habitually raped three times a month, every single month, for 7 years.
And I think that she does really go into the mental toll that takes as best she can in her testimony. Like, I agree, there's a lot more that she's not getting across. But when she talks about slapping Fred, or when he slapped her and then she slapped him back, and she smirks, and I just loved that smirk on her face so much, because it was so great. She was so damn proud of herself then, as she should be. And she's still proud of herself as she takes the stand to talk about it as he's standing right there. But she admits that she was past caring about whether or not the consequences of that slap would get her killed. She's like, it just didn't really matter to me. So, I mean, she even admits it a little bit in her testimony that she was suicidal, that all of these habitual traumas and ceremonies and experiences put her to a point where she didn't care if she lived as long as she got to slap this asshole back once.
I also appreciated that she shows Serena a little bit of levity, which was very bizarre. And for me, like, at first I thought that she was just like going to go in guns blazing, take Serena down too. And I thought that her mentioning that Serena did try to help once and lost her finger, I don't know from an optic standpoint if that was the right play, because it does sort of humanize Serena a little bit and makes her more sympathetic. But I thought that, like, for me, like, I read this as, this is the first sliver that we see of June starting to heal from all of this, is that instead of just going in guns blazing, burn the whole thing down, she's like, you know what? She's like, she tried in whatever pathetic way that she could to stand up. And she lost a fucking finger, which her husband condoned. I think that had she been fully still in that place of anger, that she might not have relayed that piece of information in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can see how that would have come, especially once she's gotten that release of saying exactly what she wants to say to Serena. She can look at it a little bit with less rage and specific vengefulness for Serena, because I feel like what we saw in Serena's cell was a very specific issue that Serena was bringing up. She wanted forgiveness, and June was like, fuck you, I don't owe you any forgiveness. But in this situation, she is giving a testimony, and this is part of how it all went down. I don't know if she was necessarily like throwing Serena a bone, because I do think that optics-wise, it does hurt Serena. So I thought that was kind of clever and smart. But I do think that June's always had a pretty good understanding that as much as she has her own personal issues with Serena, there is bigger fish to fry in this situation. Like, I think June's always been pretty cognizant of the fact that Serena can only do so much within her role. And that, yes, she has abused her power, hurt June over and over and over again, and she shouldn't be let off the hook in any way whatsoever. But also, even when she would try to do anything, you know, A, she can't hide the fact that she's missing a finger. So the story starts to hold up. And most importantly to me is it really fractures that, like, devout and faithful Gilead family that Fred and Serena are trying to put out right now. And it's a reminder to the world of, like, yeah, you think they believe this bullshit? No, they don't, actually. Because she wanted to, you know, she tried to read and got her finger cut off. And here we are. Like, this was insane even for two Serena.
I like that perspective on that. Nice.
I like how she talks about, like, how even in their own country of Gilead, the rapes that were not legally sanctioned would have had consequences for Fred and Serena.
Right. You know,
I feel like when June was done and they just kind of, like, you know, they pan out over, like, the faces and stuff, Fred looked like Fred. Fred wears perfectly the face of every white man who is shocked to hear that someone else didn't think he was as fantastic as he thought himself to be. That's normal. Serena, however, has a look on her face like, we're so fucked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She really did. But now the defense can ask questions, and they remind her that this is not a trial. And this woman, the attorney, she comes up and she says, you had an affair with a married man for months. And she's doing just the typical thing that defense lawyers will do in this situation, where she's trying to show a history of unsavory behavior. It's to raise doubt about the victim, to save their client's ass. That doesn't make it any more comforting to the victim, who has to defend their right to, you know, not be raped. But this victim blaming shit is one of a thousand reasons that rape victims don't come forward.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was so inadequate. Like, she was like a fly coming up to bother June.
Right.
June swatted her off very effectively by refuting her points. You chose to become a handmaid. Well, wasn't much of a choice, or I go to the colonies. Well, so that's a yes. You know what you signed up for. Well, I didn't sign to be raped at 9 months pregnant, so no. And then Fred goes and fucks himself over real hard by not presenting himself in the best light. Once again, Fred's not so good at the optics, is he? He should have kept his mouth shut.
I don't know. I think he was smart. Why?
Because you do not do that.
No, I mean, I don't want him to talk. No, I agree with that part of it.
Oh,
but
no. Fred sucks at this. That's what I mean. Fred sucks at the optics. Like, you do not do this.
I think that's why the end is the way it is, because it's what he said. He said, they heard me.
Mm-hmm.
Putting on a show, not for that courtroom, but for everyone else that's going to read the paper and hear what he said later.
I'm with Marjorie on this one.
I think that was his goal.
But it doesn't matter. It's the holy ceremony. What is the holy ceremony? Is to rape.
No, I agree with you. No, yeah. I know, but all those people care. They showed up to support him after that. It was a siren call of, let me get all of these religious zealots back in my corner. Of, I wasn't doing this to hurt her. I was doing this for humanity and for God and for all these things. I agree with you. He shouldn't have spoken. I hated every word he said. But I think this was Fred's spin. This was his plan all along, to go on this script and to make this fuss. And then when all of a sudden everyone's cheering him, he's like, I guess it worked.
But I don't believe it works, though, because it's false comfort. Those Christian crazies are always going to stand outside of every courtroom or every, like, you know, whatever legal proceeding there is to support their extraordinarily shitty person. That doesn't mean that they're in the majority. That doesn't mean that they have a majority of support within the courts. No, it just means that a bunch of hypocritical assholes came out to stand with their very own hypocritical asshole, as we've seen.
But that's what he was doing. That's all I mean.
He was dog whistling, just like all of the other, you know, Christian dominionists have been doing over the last 4 years every time they get in trouble. That's all he was doing, and I don't think it's going to be effective. It doesn't matter how he looks to the media. It matters how he looks to the court. And I think that doing this, it was another holy ceremony. Oh, okay. Did you just come up with that right now, Fred, because you were pissed off because you got called out for what it actually was? If his lawyer didn't hear that before and the rest of the court didn't hear that before, they're going to be like, oh, So now it's a holy ceremony. Awesome. How else would you like to change your story that we didn't hear about before?
Right.
That's why I'm like, Fred is a dumb fuck, and he's not as good as optics as he thinks he is. And that's why Serena, I would love to see what Serena is going to do after this. I know she walked out hand in hand after, but I really hope that her coaching is going to come along with, you need to shut the fuck up because you're not helping us.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess I just feel like we can't say it hasn't worked because it remains to be seen. We haven't seen past it, you know? So that's why I just feel like so far from what we've seen, that's what he was doing. And it feels like it did work to me. And that's alarming. I wish it wouldn't. And I hear what you're saying of it's not the majority of the public and it doesn't really matter what the public says feels to begin with. But we've seen that just within the political dealings, the public opinion does matter. We saw it when he was in Canada last time. So to some sense, I just feel like he was very good at getting people to be like, oh my God, look, we had a baby. This is God's miracle. And all these people are like, you know what? He's right. Not all the people, but enough of those crazy people outside to believe that God is speaking through Serena by putting this magic baby in her.
Yeah, I just think it's going to end up hurting him because going off about how God tests us with a heavy hand, and then he launches into this diatribe about how the rape was so worth it because look how great the environment is doing. And who got their wife knocked up? Yeah. I did. See, Gilead rape works. Everybody should try it. That's what I feel like his standing up in front of the courtroom did for him. That did not help him. I don't believe it helped him.
I think that it helped him purely in the short term in the court of public opinion because he was able to, with doing that and utilizing Serena as a prop and mm-hmm. stepping out of turn, which she calls him out on in her own way, he mobilized a vocal minority. And though I think we can all agree that in the long term, from a like an actual courtroom perspective, it was a foolhardy measure for him to do. Like, sit down, shut up, and let your lawyer do the job. What he did in this case is by inspiring that vocal minority. We already know well enough, like in this country, whenever you have a relatively loud, even if they are a small group, as soon as religion becomes part of the conversation, everyone starts tiptoeing around it. Everything becomes much more delicate. You don't want to offend. You don't want to infringe on other people's religious rights. And by getting these people out there with those signs and like getting them to stand up for what they viewed as like praise be Serena Joy, God bless the Waterfords, things like that, it brings religion into the conversation. And people are always trepidatious to step on anyone's toes. So I think that was kind of smart of Fred to vocalize that minority, because like this is the minority that people are the least inclined. They're inclined to say from a moral standpoint that they are wrong and incorrect, but it's much harder to silence that crowd. And we saw that, we see that in the before times when like they're making their book tour. This vocal minority is ultimately what fuels that fire. And like he's trying to capitalize on that same exact thing again here by utilizing Serena as a prop.
He's also energizing the base of these highly religious people in the middle of a fertility crisis. People are so tunnel visioned with religion. Like we see it all the time in this country. People will vote for one issue and one issue only. There are plenty of people who will just vote for the anti-choice, pro-life candidate if it means that they are against abortions and they don't care about anything else. We saw it with the last election. This guy, there are people that voted for Trump twice on solely the idea that they think he's against abortion, when in reality, he doesn't really fucking give a shit about any of it. Like, he just says whatever. He's like Fred. He will just say whatever he needs to get people behind him. And I feel like that's what he was doing as well, because if people can tunnel vision past all the rapes, if it means God's precious miracle is going to be here.
So I felt like he was trying to actually make it sound less sinister than it actually was get that support. Like, I don't think it's going to work, but I do agree that that's what he was doing. I mean, it's just like our members of the GQP Congress that like to say January 6th was just a normal tour day at the Capitol. We all know it ain't true, buddy. But go on and say it. You look like a jackass all the same. when he says we chose God's path and we have been rewarded, June flies off the stand with, how was I rewarded?
She's out of the box.
She's out of the box.
Yes. That was really cool, though. I really mean this. Yep. Like, she seriously was like, no, I don't have to stand here and take this right now. I can tell you exactly what I want to say. And then I've said it before in the season, and I feel like it happens a lot. And I feel like it might be the Elizabeth Moss directed episodes. There is a lot of face-to-face confrontation, and she flies right off that box and goes right into his face. And I loved it.
It was awesome. I think if she could have participated him herself, she would
have. Yeah, right?
Oh, yeah.
And again, with Serena's face, what were you seeing there? Like, there was something on her face, and I just couldn't pick it up. And I almost wanted to say, like, I wanted to see maybe just, like, a smidge of admiration. I just feel like Serena would appreciate June standing up for something, period. I do think that Serena appreciates seeing another woman actually stand up and succeed at something.
Yeah.
Even though she made sure that that nobody else will.
Right. Right. But she channels that same energy a lot. Like, we've seen it. Yeah, we've seen her. Well, especially recently, like, now that she's been in Canada, like, even though she's locked up, we say it all the time. Like, she's the fact that she challenges Tuello. She gets right in his face. She charges at him. It's all the same stuff. Again, they are two sides of the same goddamn coin. Like, they just are. And I feel like I don't know if that's what I had a hard time trying to figure out what's on Serena's face. I feel like that's constantly. It's something I'm always trying to exactly just read what she's thinking, because she just tends to surprise me. Just when I think she's on the right track, she's not. So I don't want to say I saw too much admiration in there, because I don't really know what it was.
Yeah.
But I do think she at least recognized that someone was standing up to Fred in that way.
I saw envy.
That's a good one, too.
I think actually, yeah, what was it?
Envy, because she definitely is a sort, like, she appreciates that a woman is standing up, but she wants that. She has been trying for so long to have her voice back, and it has been at least 7 years since she has had a platform with which to have a voice. They even mentioned, like, June even mentions in her testimony that Serena tried to stand up and have a voice and had a finger removed because of it. I think that face that Serena was making was part, I can see like a bit of like admiration or like perhaps like appreciation, but for me it read as envy. Envy that June was able to stand up and tell her story uninterrupted. And the judge even said, on your time, like gave her an open invitation. And Serena is so desperate for that platform and for a voice. I had to be given her voice back, which we sort of see her get back in a slight way at the tail end of the episode. But for me, like, that's how I read that, was like not anger envy, but just like, I want that.
Yeah.
I want to be the one doing that.
What I wrote was she's envious of her freedom. The fact that she can march right up to Fred, where we've seen that Serena at this up until very recently in the season, she's been trying to get as far away from Fred as possible. She wants, if nothing else, the freedom from Fred. And this pregnancy has pulled her right back in, and June's arrival had pulled her right back into Fred's side. Like, now they have to have optics and they have to have a united front. And here's June, and she gets to be rid of them whenever she wants. She gets to leave that testimony whenever she wants. She walks right out. Like, I think Serena is envious of her freedom.
I think you may be right, dear.
And I love that June just slams down and says, I am done. I am done. Anything more can wait for your trial. And then turns on a heel and walks out straight shot towards the camera. Like, it's such a gratifying moment where she's acknowledging that she doesn't have to give more of herself to these people. And she won't. She can come and go on her own terms. And that for her is the freedom that she's been seeking.
Serena can't do any of that.
Nope, not at all. It's the quintessential Elizabeth Moss slow walk out of a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And she left Serena there clutching her pearls.
Yeah.
And Fred wondering what the hell happened. She's got her power back.
She does. I have just one other thought about this scene that I wanted to jump back. Oh, two thoughts. I do remember them now. Scarlett, first of all, we got Discord music, and, you know, it's terrible because it's always everything's awful and terrible. But yeah, it was when the female attorney started cross-examination, or not cross, but whatever it was. And yeah, like as soon as she gets into the, but you chose this, like, I forget the exact dialogue, but it was right around the time where you're like, pretty quickly when you're like, oh, wow, she's coming at her pretty hard. And the music just gets really Discord. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so cool.
I missed it.
Yeah, and then I love the music at the end of June's testimony when she was talking about the in memoriam. It was so beautiful, and then it got all discordy at that point. So that was the song. And then my other thought was I love the also quintessential Elizabeth Moss shot, Handmaid's Tale June shot that we get when Fred starts speaking up and she looks down into the side and it's kind of this weird look because I'm like, what is she looking at? What is happening there? And all that it reminded me of was something that she had even brought up in her testimony, which was when she slapped him. And I remember in that scene, he slaps her, right? If I recall correctly, he slaps her across the face and it kind of knocks her to the side. And you get that shot of like her just kind of stealing herself. And then she's just like, nope, I'm coming back for him. And so she does the same thing when he starts to talk and she looks down and I think she's getting overwhelmed. And that's when she comes back for him and she like metaphorically slaps him in the face by charging out of that box. It was really cool. I love that shot.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah, that little like that side glance that she had where she's like looking out of the corner of her eye and you could just like you could see her starting to seethe. And I absolutely love that notion of looking at it like a metaphoric slap in the face to him.
Sinister side eye.
Because that's what he was trying to do. Because he was trying to slap her down. He was trying to do exactly what she said in the testimony.
Wow.
And cut out her tongue. That's what he was trying to do. Shut her up.
Exactly.
Well, join us back here for part two of season four, episode 8. What is this thing called?
Testimony.
Thank you. Didn't write that title at the top of my notes. Testimony. We will see you soon. Love us? Hate us? Either way, let us know. We appreciate feedback from intels and incels. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Or you can just shoot us an email at redresistancepodcast@gmail.com. We'd like to give special thanks to Mr. Scarlett for making our podcast sound amazing. Without him, we'd be all fuzz and echoes. We'd also like to give a shout out to Peter Levesque of Heliovox for providing us with our badass intro and outro music. Thank you for listening, and try not to let the bastards grind you down.